Good evening and happy Pride. Welcome to the June 2024 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, it is Pride Week here in the Bay Area and a great time for storytelling about our history and our community. Tonight I have back with me two guests who were on at different times this last year and who both published memoirs sharing their personal stories with the world. You might remember Corey Allen. He's the U.S. Secret Service agent who was responsible for protecting the Obama family and the Pope during one of the Pope's visits to the United States. His book is titled Breaking Free. And also my good friend Ryan Olson is with us tonight to share his memoir titled Finding My Humanity. Both will talk about their pride and the process of writing a book that opens up their life to the world. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, June 23rd, 2024. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of June 23rd, 2024. An eighth grade boy has lost his appeal in a case that tested the right of school administrators to regulate hate speech on school campuses. In 2023, 12-year-old Liam Morrison sued John T. Nichols Middle School in Middlesbrough, Massachusetts, after he was barred from class for wearing a t-shirt on campus bearing the phrase, quote, "There are only two genders," end quote. An expression often used by anti-LGBTQ plus activists to mean that trans identities are not valid. Morrison, who was then in seventh grade, was called into a meeting with administrators who told him there had been complaints about his t-shirt and the message that it contained. They also said that it violated the school's prohibition on hate speech. After being told that he would have to remove the shirt before returning to class, Morrison refused and left school for the day. There was no subsequent disciplinary action taken. 2 months later, Morrison showed up again on campus with the same shirt, but with the word censured taped over a portion of the message. Morrison was again told he would have to remove the shirt or be barred from going to class. He again chose to leave school for the day. Morrison wore other t-shirts on other days with political messages as well, including, quote, "Don't tread on me," and, quote, "First Amendment rights," and he was not required to remove either of those shirts. Morrison is represented by the Crusading Alliance Defending Freedom, a group designated by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group. Chief Judge David Barron wrote the opinion for a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. He said, quote, "In following the lead of other courts that have grappled with similar cases, we emphasize that in many realms of public life, one must bear the risk of being subjected to messages that are demeaning of race, sex, religion, or sexual orientation, even when those messages are highly disparaging of those characteristics. But while the Supreme Court precedent holds that schools must permit debate over even the most contentious and controversial topics, it doesn't follow that our public schools must be a similar unregulated place." Alliance Defending Freedom said that they are likely to appeal this decision. Last week in California, the state Senate approved a proposal that would ban school districts from passing or enforcing policies requiring school staff to disclose a student's gender identity or sexual orientation to anyone else without the child's permission, with some exceptions. The goal is to protect students whose safety could be threatened if they live in an unwelcoming household. Lawmakers approved the legislation largely along party lines after more than an hour of emotional debate in which Democratic LGBTQ plus senators recounted stories about how they delayed coming out to their parents or were outed by someone else. They argued gender nonconforming students should also be able to come out to their families on their own terms. But Republican lawmakers said the state shouldn't dictate whether school districts can enforce so-called parental notification policies and that schools have an obligation to be transparent with parents. This is all part of a nationwide debate over local school districts and the rights of parents and LGBTQ plus students. States across the country have sought out to impose bans on gender-affirming care, bar transgender athletes from girls and women's sports, and require schools to out trans and non-binary students to their parents. Some lawmakers in other states have introduced bills in their legislatures with broad language requiring that parents be notified of any changes to their child's emotional health or well-being. Republican State Senator Kelly Ciardo, who represents Murrieta in Southern California, said schools should increase transparency with parents by notifying them of their child's gender identification change. The bill now heads to the state assembly, where it would need to pass in committee and then on the floor before it reaches Governor Gavin Newsom for final approval. And here in the Bay Area, San Francisco leaders declared that the city of San Francisco is a sanctuary for transgender people, becoming the first in the nation to do so amid a push by some conservative states to limit transgender rights. The Board of Supervisors voted unanimously to declare San Francisco a sanctuary city for transgender, gender nonconforming, non-binary, and two-spirit people. Sacramento and West Hollywood have also declared themselves sanctuary cities to transgender people, but San Francisco is the first major city in the country to call itself a safe place for transgender and gender nonconforming people. The Transgender Sanctuary Resolution is largely symbolic, but it will be a guiding document for law enforcement in San Francisco in dealing with outside agencies on transgender issues. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moraglio. Los Angeles LGBT Center, which provides services to and programming to aid LGBTQ individuals. And don't forget, Sonoma County Pride returns this year with in-person events happening June 3rd through the 5th. The festival and parade will happen in Old Courthouse Square on June 4th. Tune in for this month's Outbeat Extra on May 29th at 8 p.m. for a conversation with Sonoma County Pride organizers. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moraglio. One of the common experiences shared by almost every member of the LGBTQ plus community is that of coming out. It can be one of the first experiences of actually feeling pride as an LGBTQ plus person. And the sharing of these stories in books can be both inspiring and powerful, not only for those who read them, but for the authors themselves. My guests tonight have both decided to share their personal stories with the world. Corey Allen in his book called Breaking Free, and Ryan Olson in his book titled Finding My Humanity. Welcome and happy Pride to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us back. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it's exciting to have you both back, especially celebrating Pride this month. Our theme really is about the importance of sharing stories. Both of you wrote books sharing your own very personal stories. And you've both been on the show before independently. Great to have you back together. But let's start out by having you talk a little bit about yourselves. Tell us who you are and what you do for a living and what sort of what brought you to this point. Corey, start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, I was on your show last year, I think around the same time, it was during Pride Month. So it's fantastic to be back a year later, and so much has transpired since then. I've been in law enforcement. This is now my 21st year. I was with the Secret Service for 10 of those years. I left DC in 2019, fled to the West Coast to try and do a hard life reset. And then through the process of recalibrating my life, my memoir came out of that as I was documenting being assigned to the Obamas, like how being a member of the LGBTQ community in a hyper-masculine environment like law enforcement, the impacts on that and the Secret Service, how it played into my personal life. So it was really a cathartic process for me, and my memoir came out of it. And then that's how we connected. Hard to believe it's been a year ago. But yeah, it's been an amazing journey. I look forward to talking more about that here shortly.
Awesome. Ryan, we were just talking before we went on the air. We've known each other coming up on two decades.
I really watched you from
an early college student now into a professional and now an author. Talk about what in your life brought you to the work that you're doing and to want to write.
Yeah, well, first and foremost, I'm grateful to be on this back on the show with you to talk a little bit more about my memoir. But yeah, I started off as a young, sullen youth in middle America, unsure of my future and what it held for someone like me as a young gay kid, and slowly but surely became an accidental activist on my private Catholic school campus where you and I first interacted. I fell in love for the first time and realized, hey, this thing that I thought was dark was actually this beautiful, profound part of what makes me whole. And isn't it a shame the whole world doesn't see it the same? So I began an activism career, which has since taken me to great heights, including working at the UN, living around the world, working with activists to help them pursue their own equity in their various country contexts. And so from that sullen youth in Middle America to now leading global movements for LGBT rights, I just felt compelled to share a little bit of my story in the memoir we're about to talk about, Finding My Humanity.
Was there something or a particular event that lit the fire for you around activism?
It was truly falling in love, but then But then also the degrees of hatred and bigotry that I was experiencing in micro and macro ways, not only on my college campus, but in the broader rhetoric in the United States in the early 2000s, where, you know, issues of LGBT rights were being discussed, but often about those people over there and often without the voices of people from the community. And so I just felt compelled to step up, something I never foresaw as a part of my journey as a young person. Just it happened.
And Corey, how about for you? I mean, you and I both entered law enforcement in different generations, but both in times where you could not be out as a gay person. It was just not accepted. I mean, I would argue that it's still not widely accepted. But what was the catalyst for you? I mean, you've been an activist in your own way within the profession, and now in sharing your story. But was there an event that for you said something's got to change here?
I don't know if there was a specific event. I mean, the pandemic happened, and I'd written my book leading up to that, and then we had all this time on our hands, pandemic. So that led me to push to do something with what I had written. And it was actually Stephen Rowler's book, the editor, Stephen Rowley, that I connected with because he was, you know, it's fiction, but, you know, he was an editor. Jackie O was the editor, and I connected due to the First Lady Nexus. So I was like, oh, I see a path of viability here, and maybe I should be doing something with this. At the time, I wasn't even promoted yet. I was still just a special agent. I don't know. It just kind of, it's taken on its own life form. And through the last 12 months have been wild. What's been done and the message I received from the community. And I've now been promoted twice since I wrote the book, and I'm now the special agent in charge leading an entire region. And it's also now part of my responsibility to make sure that my story is being told so we can recruit the next generation of amazing law enforcement professionals. And they know that regardless of a sexuality or gender or whatever, that they are welcome, they are needed to affect the changes in law enforcement that have to occur here. And it's got to occur from within first. So that's now the driving force, as well as LGBT advocacy and IVF surrogacy stuff too.
So super interesting. Your agency has responded obviously and very positively to sort of exposing your story or sharing it with the world. In fact, if I heard you right, you got promoted as, at least in part, because of that?
I got promoted almost a month ago now. So now it's insane that I lead 5 offices in 13 Western states, and they have that trust in me while also allowing me to do the LGBTQ advocacy work on the side. Of course, they're not related in any way, shape, or form, but being that visible symbol to others takes on new meaning as now the actual leader for our region. And so that is not lost on me, and it's really important that we continue to push that forward.
I think if you would have talked about your experience back in 1978, that would have been the reason I would have been fired, as opposed to being promoted and celebrated. So that to me is very optimistic. That's really kind of exciting to hear, especially coming from a federal agency. And federal agencies tend to be a little bit more conservative and a little bit slower to evolve than perhaps local agencies do.
Yeah, it's compared to being, you know, as I wrote in the book, the terror of, you know, being afraid of being fired and being discriminated against both at the local level and federally. So to see that, those massive changes. Now I'm no longer with the Secret Service, but so I'm super fortunate that the agency I'm with now is amazing and super supportive. But yeah, we've still got work to do, but it's great to see them behind me in all of this.
Yeah, at least not being oppressed, being celebrated.
Absolutely.
Ryan, I remember going up to Gonzaga and meeting with the LGBT group that you had first started. And it was winter, I believe. And we were kind of traipsing through to this building, and the meeting took place in a basement. It was very secret. I got a chance to return to Gonzaga more than a decade later, and now there's this beautiful two-story student services building with a very, very visible, very well-labeled Pride Center. When you started bringing this group together and started this work, did you envision that that was going to be a possibility?
Well, first and foremost, I'd love to take credit for starting it, but I took over the group after it had started off originally a few years prior, because it was more of a self-help group started by the Jesuits, and is more, I don't want to say gay conversion therapy, but pray the gay away type of group. It wasn't allowed to be called an LGBT group. In fact, we had to call it Helping Educate Regarding Orientation Hero. And as I was on my campus as a young freshman, I had actually just done a internship at Disney World, and I dated Prince Charming and Aladdin and, you know, discovered myself, and then come back to this college campus where everybody's in the group is a little, you know, wary and still kind of discreet. And I'm like, what's going on? I don't get it. And so I eventually took over the group and kind of turned it from being that sullen space in the back of this room to a place where over a quarter of the student body was on our listserv, and we had lots and lots of people come regularly to it. And I think that one of the shifting moments of my time there that led me to my current career in global advocacy is that I had a shift in mindset from a lot of people who had been leading activism before, and that was recognizing my inherent worth as a human being and the dignity that comes with that, but also that this was something not to be ashamed of, but was full of love and light. And here I was on this college campus where we were talking about social justice and giving one of oneself to others in the name of a higher good. And here I was kind of thrust into having to face the gauntlet, if you will. And so as we continued to build out the work, we used positive forms of advocacy, talking about love, interconnectedness, being able to think about neighborliness, and centered around the same social justice mission that the university claimed it was touting, and leveraging that back to the university. So when it comes to legacy, the legacy of the work, not just on my own, but of many whom stood up and had hard conversations, now two decades later, it's so powerful to see that that conversation has evolved and sustained itself to, I'm sure, what they're facing, probably even more issues as any college campus is, but to have the visibility and support that wasn't just from students, but also from many others. And then the last thing I'll say is it was my colleague and peer, Bryce Hughes, who started the LGBT Center back in our day and in the basement. And it was through his courage that then this center became an institutional framework that then got supported and built into their brand new student center. Yeah. So,
and you and I share a common experience of being dramatically impacted by the story of Matthew Shepard. For me, it was a life-changing moment. For you, you got a chance to actually work at the foundation, and that's where you and I met. Talk a little bit about Matt's story and how that guided you toward the work that you're doing.
Well, yeah, as I spoke earlier, a little bit about being a sullen youth in Middle America, and that was in Colorado, just a mere hour away from where Matt had been murdered. And I was a junior in high school, junior high, and just I wasn't sure of myself or what LGBT even meant, but I certainly remembered that there was this guy that got killed for being gay just down the block or just down the road from me. In fact, where Matt ultimately died was in the same hospital I had been born in. And so then years later, I'm on this college campus talking about erasing hate and overcoming biases and had the good fortune of working in the student activities office, and thought to bring Judy Shepherd, mother of Matthew Shepherd, to speak to our college campus about where hate can lead. And during that time, I got to develop a personal relationship with Judy, where she was just such an inspiration to me and a support to me while I was somewhat isolated on my campus. And so we remained in touch. And she followed my movements to the point where she actually, I was one of the people that she honored with one of her Making a Difference awards in 2005. And so I stayed in touch with the family and the foundation, and eventually got to do a summer internship there, where I learned about some of the nuts and bolts of advocacy at a national level. And remain in touch with the family and the foundation to this day, always and perpetually being inspired by Matt's life, not only the tragic ending, but whom he was as a person, someone full of light, full of love, so much that he gave to the world in his short period of time. And being so inspired by his family's love for him, it's also continued to inspire me in my own journey as I roll out into the world in all these country contexts, where there's many, many more Matts, unfortunately, though, many whom don't make headlines, right, or are lost to hatred in different ways.
Yeah, that's for sure. Corey, you and I share the experience of getting into law enforcement. Did you know you were gay at the time when you were interested in the profession?
I was deeply closeted. I dated women up until I was 26 or 27. But my law enforcement interactions, like the inspiration was way earlier when we had domestic violence in the home growing up. And I was the one calling police for help to stop the abuse and calm things down. So those are the interactions that I had. I later worked for that same agency as a police officer. So that's, it goes quite a ways back.
So I'm curious, what about the work? I mean, what was so powerful in terms of attracting you to that line of work? Knowing at the time who you were, I mean, you had to have some sense that gay people were not welcomed in the profession at the time. What drew you to it despite that?
I know it sounds cliche, but it was in the innate sense to help, to see the impact that they had on me and my life. And I was so deeply closeted, I couldn't reconcile what was going on underneath. Even when I entered law enforcement at 24, I was 24. All that was lying underneath, but I was doing what society told me I needed to be doing, and dating women and hiding this, my true feelings and my true self was just buried so far down, because that's a community I grew up in, deeply conservative. It still is to this day. So it wasn't a warm and welcoming place, but that was so far beneath the surface that it didn't pop up until I was able to progress personally a few years later. Then I was in the profession by that point, and I just had to cope and deal with the discrimination and the gay bashing and all that kind of came with it.
And I know you talk about this in your book, but what was that like for you when you came to that realization? Now you're deep into the profession. You're committed in the profession. You talk in there about your love of the job and the passion that you had for the job. And so now you've got this conflicting piece of you that is a powerful influence. How did you reconcile that?
I lived two different lives, two separate lives. I just had to isolate my work life from my personal life. And once I went federal, we were living in Miami. And I just made sure, once I was discriminated against there, and my job was in danger because they could literally just fire me. And I had a classmate who was fired. She was an African-American lesbian, and they fired her. And in the first 3.5 years, they could just fire you for anything. And so I was terrified of that, because now I was married to my new husband, and everything was riding on me being successful in this job in a new foreign city and state. So I just completely separated the two and made sure that there was never any crossover between the two. We lived on South Beach, so none of my straight peers were ever really over in South Beach at the gay bars, so we were safe there. Was never able to take my spouse with me to office events or picnics or anything like that. You just gotta isolate and protect.
I'm not sure many folks in your shoes would have made that leap from the agency where you started to jump into something that was even more risky and less accepting. What motivated you to make that leap and then jump into the Secret Service, which is fascinating, I think, for many, many people. It's very mysterious, but it's not the most welcoming agency for gay folks.
I was naive at the time, and I thought that going federal, I wanted to live in a new city and state. I love to travel, and I knew that, okay, I love Richmond, Virginia. It's a great place, but I knew it just wasn't where I could succeed personally. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I wanted to go federal once I finished my bachelor's degree. I knew I wanted to go federal somewhere, and the Secret Service nabbed me before the FBI could. So that's why I went federal, and I was under the assumption that I was now federal and I would have all these protections and I wouldn't be discriminated against and I would be warmed and welcomed. And then, of course, it was not the case at all. That took a few more years and Supreme Court decisions to start to fix that. I still to this day, obviously, I'm still in the profession. I don't know, had to grin and bear it.
That must have taken an awful lot of courage.
I don't know what to label it. And actually, I did an interview a few months ago, and the interviewee pointed out something I'd never thought of, that I was in complete and absolute control in my professional life, protecting presidents and Pope and whatever. But in my personal life, like, the wheels were falling off the bus and the stresses were coming out in the bottom of a cocktail glass. They never, you know, it never affected my professional life. But off duty, I was consuming a lot of alcohol socially, and that's where the stresses were popping up and out, where I was not in a whole lot of control in my personal life. And I was like, oh, that's, yeah, you're absolutely right. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, and that's the manifestation of having to lead two separate lives and manage the two so that they don't intersect, you know, and when there are those, where that barrier gets penetrated and there's an overlap and a threat to your well-being professionally because of something that you're doing personally, that stress is enormous. I can absolutely identify with that.
Yeah, and it's not something, you know, the mental health aspect of being in law enforcement is just now starting to change, where it's okay to talk about the tragedies that we witness and, you know, homicide scenes or whatever it is that you deal with and those stresses of the CDI programs and people like Ryan are out there doing really good work to push things forward to make sure that, hey, it's okay to say you're hurting. This is too much for you. You know, look at the alcoholism rates in law enforcement. It's double that of the national average. To police suicides are off the chart. And that is so much preventable, mm-hmm. as long as we start talking about our vulnerabilities and being authentic and making sure we know that it's okay to be human in these roles.
Ryan, was there ever a point where you, in your life, in your career path, where you had to lead the double life, where you couldn't be your authentic self?
If I'm honest, I think that's where I've struggled the most, is that I can't not be my authentic self. So but I do, as I travel around the world, I work in really entrenched places, from Jamaica to Nigeria, Kenya, where I do have to navigate being an out person. I do have, in those contexts, I have a lot of privilege at being a white Western male, of course. But there's always the water's edge, that possibility of being outed or harmed in some other way. And so I'm constantly having to navigate the safeguarding of myself, especially when I'm traveling abroad. With that said, I don't want to also dismiss that even in my workplace here in the US, I also, and in life, there is always the subtleties of it, you know, of there's always the risk that come with, that is inherent with just being an out person in the world and someone somewhere just having an issue with you. So it's not necessarily a double life, but something I'm cognizant, have to be far more cognizant of than, may say, an out person.
So you work in an organization that is deeply involved in supporting LGBT issues as well as others, but that's a key component of the work, right? Do you think that the folks that you work with, by and large, and the organization is authentic in its support? Or do you think sometimes you get lip service because people want to sound and say the right thing?
I will say that I think that a lot of people have good intentions, and that they, not just my work, but all workplaces have worked through navigating LGBT issues in a workplace. And so I have, because of the, and I've never necessarily worked directly on, well, I've worked on LGBT issues, but couched within things like global health and HIV, sexual reproductive health and rights. And so I have a lot of colleagues who bring with them, as all people do, their personal biases and prejudices. With that said, I've strived to see the best of intentions wherever they may fall. For example, my current company was the very first company to sponsor a Pride Parade contingent last year, and it was the first firm of its kind to do so here in DC. So they put some money where their mouth is, but as I said, all firms everywhere are continuing to evolve in this space, and it's my hope to do help people along that journey.
Corey, let me ask you a similar question about the culture at the federal level. So I know in working with some federal agencies under the Trump administration that based on policies that came out of that office, that attitudes towards things like diversity training, LGBT issues shifted. They were shut down. And I think there were some folks that I talked with, that I worked with, who used that to their advantage because they didn't believe in what we were trying to do anyway. I guess the question is, do you think that there is an authentic desire to embrace things like DEI at the federal level, specifically around LGBT people, or do you think that there's lip service being paid because the current administration is sort of touting that policy?
So, of course, I can only speak to the agencies in which I've worked, and I'm very fortunate the one where I'm currently at and where I plan to retire from. There is, like, as Ryan said, the money is where their mouth is. Like, there's the head of our agency is all about CDI programs, and it's mandatory every year, and there's, you know, one being held. We have to go to Atlanta here soon. These are mandatory for everybody, and they genuinely believe that this is the path we have to be on. So yeah, during the last administration, even now, there's people on the right who seem to think that being inclusive is a bad thing, whether it's your immigration status or whether it's your sexuality or your race. Like, they seem to think that that's a bad thing when it is so powerful and it's what we have to do. And it brings so much amazing, so many amazing things to the table. My current agency, of course, I can speak for you. I know there's proof in the pudding. However, I still feel we are lacking in the LGBTQ angle. And so I was talking with an acquaintance, and they're with a DOJ OIG, and they are head of the LGBTQ unit for DOJ OIG. And I'm like, oh, well, we don't really have anything like that here. We have CDI programs, but there isn't really an emphasis on being queer. And that's something I hope to navigate through now that I'm in my new position of affecting the change, and afterward talk with Ryan to figure out if we could work together and something he can bring to the table as well of trying to incorporate some of that and figure out a path forward to make sure that we are addressing all of that.
And that's really what it takes, doesn't it? It takes individuals to step up and say, I want to do this.
Well, if I could add, you know, I think one of the things that I did do is we developed a global gender and sexual diversity training and sensitized multiple U.S. missions around the world, including ambassadors all the way down to drivers and everybody in between. And I think along a lot of agencies, organizations, et cetera, individuals, like I said, are on that journey. And so like I did on my college campus, the approach of helping people bringing people along, even it's that messy middle, as opposed to it being 100% perfect or nothing at all. It's discovering and exploring together. And yes, there are those opposing forces that unfortunately are trying to curtail or push back some of this work. But for the good majority of the folks that I interact with, at least, I think people just are eager to learn and grow as people. and have honest questions that, when provided the space, can work through and actually come out on the other side in support and affirming of diversity and inclusion, but specifically LGBTI human rights. Yep.
Oh, I totally agree with you. And I think I have my own experience in that, doing LGBT awareness training for law enforcement across the country. The same thing is true. There is a large group of people who don't know. And so when they're given information and they have the chance to be able to learn in a non-threatening environment, a non-judgmental environment, then that creates a shift. Of course, there will always be those folks who want nothing to do with it, probably out of fear, homophobia, whatever the reason happens to be. But providing training, providing discussion in a comfortable space that is safe for people, that's the way to go. Right.
It's also incumbent on us to be the examples of even the surrogacy journey. We're on two surrogacy journeys right now, of normalizing, because they may not have LGBTQ members in their circles. They may not know anybody.
Right.
And so when I message the region and I talk about the quality of life and work-life balance, and I openly talk about being pregnant and what the IVF process was like, again, it's just normalizing. Oh, just like when we came out to our parents, like they might have freaked out, but then over time they learn, oh, we're just normal people. We just happen to love somebody of the same sex. And that's inherent. And that certainly helps break down some of those barriers.
Yeah, that's great. Which brings me to my next question about the importance of sharing stories here. And you both took the time to invest a lot of energy into writing your stories, but also demonstrated a lot of courage in exposing yourselves in print with the world. Corey, why is sharing your personal story so important to you? Why was that?
It was the only way I knew how to write. Like, I'm not a writer by trade. This just came out of life. I'm not an English major or anything like that. But being as honest as I could be when I wrote it was super, super helpful for me. And I was like, okay, well, I've just got to continue doing this because if it's helpful for me, maybe it'll help somebody else. Of just being authentic and vulnerable. And there's so much power in being authentic and vulnerable because it gets to the core of the human connection. We can all relate to that. And that's what bonds us together, regardless of your political affiliation, is there's a story out there that people, it resonates. And so even as I continue writing now for Gay and Lesbian Review or my Medium page, or doing a lot of work for the next book, leaning heavily into that and continuing on that track, because that's what people are relating with. And when I get the messages from readers or whatever, it's because of that. So it's super powerful, and we all need to do more of it.
Do you think that when people share their stories, as you have, that contributes to the greater LGBT movement and the progress of our civil rights?
Oh, absolutely. Without question, even some of the nuanced stuff of talking about, I was in an open marriage, my prior relationship, and just shedding light in areas that people just may not be willing to talk about publicly when, there's swinger circles and all this other stuff going on in the heterosexual community. Well, there's no shame in any of that. Like, we're all humans. Why don't we talk about this stuff? I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Yeah. And Ryan, I'm curious about your perspective on that as well. You're a young man. Many people write memoirs when they're in the latter part of their life. Why now? And why was it important for you to do that?
That's not the first time I've heard that, by the way. for me, it was really about how blessed I feel like my life has been in terms of all the various encounters that I've had throughout my life and the good fortune that's been bestowed upon me. Maybe this is a legacy of the internalized homophobia or the bigotry I faced in my life, but there was once a moment in my life where I didn't think I'd live to be 40. And so reaching this this birthday this last year was a somewhat of a fearful moment for me. And I don't have children. I don't have family following after me. And I had all these life lessons from all of my lived experiences that I wanted to impart somehow, some way, as a form of a legacy. And the thing about this is also that, you know, it's not just that I did things, but I feel like I have unearthed and been revealed to have had revealed to me just profound life experiences and purviews about what it means to be a human being roaming this world. And further, that through these lived experiences, I've come to realize not only am I a queer person who sits at the bottom of a barrel, striving to be like everyone else and rise above, but that it's actually one of my unique gifts to have been born and evolved in the way that I have. And it, as much as it is about telling a story about helping people realize the fundamental truths and qualities that are innate within them that are beautiful and should be further exasperated, right? It's also about helping LGBT people see that they have inherent worth themselves. You know, I write about not only the shepherd's impact on my life, but I had the fortune of traveling around the world with Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who faced apartheid in South Africa and overcame all that bigotry. I saw Sima living in all sorts of horrendous circumstances around the world, suffering in a myriad of ways. And suddenly my own work to accept my own sexuality became aligned with those suffering for gender equality or against racial apartheid, et cetera, et cetera. And really has driven my passion to put it into practice. And so I've just had so many different lived experiences, met so many amazing people, that my story is really, I framed it as a heroine's journey, because while it's my journey, it's really centering all the amazing people I've met along the way who are giving of themselves and their lives to shed light on this important aspect of our lived experiences, and that is the human experience and our interconnectedness as people. And my first access to point to that, as I said, was when I first fell in love for the first time and realizing that my ability to connect with a fellow human being was the gift. Why are we so afraid of being able to love each other and authentically so, not just at a superficial level, but to truly see each other? And so bearing witness to all these different people, all these different circumstances in all these different settings, especially as it intersects with gender and sexual diversity, just really compelled me to not want to leave this earth without imparting a few of those lessons to those that may come after.
I sense a lot of passion from both of you on this. And I also sense that you both got a lot out of the experience of actually writing it, that the process of writing your memoir and putting your experiences into print in black and white, and I'll use the word expose, all of that, all of some very intimate things about your lives to the world, was cathartic. If you didn't sell a single book, would it have been worth it to you? Corey?
Yes.
Why?
It was helpful for me, and I needed it, because as I went through a divorce and I left the career Secret Service that I loved so much and my work family, I needed that to process everything, and that's what it served for me first and foremost. And to be very candid, I took a $15,000 bath last year because of writing the book. Mm-hmm. So it sold 1,000 copies, which is amazing. I come from an indie publisher, and you know, we just don't have the teams that the big five publishers have. So it was me. It was incumbent on me to make sure this gets out, and the interviews and all that, the PR push, like I funded all of that. So I took an absolute bath in it. But it didn't matter because people were resonating, it was connecting, and it's fine. And I was very fortunate and privileged to be able to invest in the project to help continue to try and get the word out. So yes, absolutely worth it.
Ryan, how about for you? If you didn't sell a single book, you printed one copy, and that's all you had, would it have been worth it?
Oh, absolutely. I agree with Corey and everything he just said in terms of, yeah, just even writing, getting it out on paper was so cathartic. But then it's not just getting it out, it's then having to read it over and over and over and over again, including a lot of the trauma that I've experienced in my life, but things that I felt were really profoundly important for me to impart to others. I'm one of those people, for those that don't know me, is a happy, effervescent, loving person. No one would guess that I've been through a lot of pain in my freaking life. And that sometimes frustrates me because I think people see my kindness and love as naivety when there's a profound depth to it. And so being able to really underscore some of the harder things and get it on paper was really important to me. And yeah, I'm at the beginning of my journey, Corey. So, but similar indie publisher, grateful for the support they provided in terms of the editing and the production of it. But now when it comes to getting it out in the world, it's been a little hard. With that said, a lot of the people whom have been a part of my journey have read the book. People see and understand me in a more complex way. And people who are doing important things themselves, and even if my book helps to inspire them in their own way or to give it off another paradigm, that's the true intention more than anything, So whether I sell one or it exists. I'm gonna bury it in some treasure, like so some aliens 100 years from now can find it, but maybe it'll do something.
I can relate to everything that both of you've said. I think sometimes, and Corey, you and I probably share this more so than Ryan, because Ryan has always been courageously out for most of your life, where Corey, you and I led that double life thing for so long, and it has to feel immensely liberating now to not only be entirely out and not have to hide, but to have your entire story out there in print for people to read. The confidence that comes from that has to have been life-changing for you.
It was also terrifying because it's so much of your personal information that's out there, and worrying what the reaction was going to be. Even, especially within my profession of, are my peers and my supervisor, like, are they going to view it the same way that I view it? Are they going to be supportive? And all that is still there. That somebody can just take it and spin it in another direction, as people like to do. So yeah, very liberating. And to be able to continue to speak candidly and write, I write on a regular basis, just lean into that is very liberating. Absolutely.
I think writing a memoir is something that people are very interested in. At the colleges I work at, we have memoir writing classes, and lots of people take it. And you all talked about, not being professional writers. That's not what you do for a living. So how did you learn how to do this? Ryan, I'll start with you.
Well, I was fortunate that I had a mentor who had done this process before and actually took a class through Georgetown University, and so introduced me to this program, where they took me through a 16-week course that kind of just helped me get everything out on paper and then transferred me to their publishing side of their work, where then the publishers worked with me with editors, those types of things. So, but certainly not, it was something that was always in my head for many years, and I just finally found an outlet to get it out. And so that's kind of where it started.
So you had a process, a class, and some infrastructure that led you through it. And did you, if you had to do it again, would you go back and do it the same way?
Yeah, I'd re definitely look at all my options and think about the process again. Ultimately, I have an amazing book that I'm really proud of. So, yeah, whether or not it was the right process at the end of the day, I have what I set out to do. So,
So
yeah.
for you would. I mean, that worked for you.
Yeah.
Awesome. And Corey, what about you? Where did you learn to do this?
I don't know. It came out, and then I just started Googling during the pandemic and found my editor through Readsy, and just I went about it on my own. I didn't have direction or guidance from anybody, and just kind of stumbled through it. Met my publisher through Instagram. It was another gay author who wrote a memoir about traumatic brain injury that he suffered his senior year of high school, and we connected through Instagram and like, hey, I'm just curious who you used to publish. And then he referred me, and the beta reader loved it. And then, so, but the second book, I'm not taking that same route. I hope that one of the big five picks up my second book once it's done and I craft a query letter and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So got a little more work to do on that yet. But yeah, I'm going to take a little different approach with book number two because I don't want to take another huge bath financially.
Right, right. And so how do you start? How do you find a publisher? How did you find an editor? I mean, you mentioned having read some memoir. You talked about the editor. Are you a big reader normally?
No.
Okay.
I mean,
I know one of the things that I did was read some other similar kinds of books that had been written to what I wanted to do. And that provided, you know, some examples of what at least was out there. It affirmed for me that there was a market for a different type of story. But it also gave me some models, right? So that's, I guess, one way to do it. But how do you find and how did you pick who you were going to work with? I mean, there's so many different indie publishers out there. There's so many editing services out there. There are so many people who are ready to sell you a package, a $15,000 package, if you will, to do this. How did you navigate and make choices about who to work with?
I hit up 50 publishers and literary agents, and the one through Instagram that connect is the first one to say, send me the full manuscript. Yes, we will publish it. And again, I was naive. I didn't know anything about the process. I didn't know that I would be doing all the marketing, the PR work. I just didn't know. So I was just navigating and Googling and just trying to do the research myself to figure it all out. So I'm very, very thankful and fortunate that it did. As Ryan said, at the end of the day, we've got a finished product that's available and it's out there for people to hopefully pick up and relate to. So I just stumbled through it.
So there are professional, that you talked about the big five publishers that are out there, and those are companies that typically offer in advance and they pay for all of the infrastructure that's required in putting together a book. But there's also a whole group of independent publishers that allow a first-time writer, we'll say at least initially an amateur writer, to be able to publish whatever you want there. And there's a lot. Do you have any experience that you can share with our listeners about what to watch for with those independent publishers?
There's perks to being indie as well. Yeah, you do all the work, and it was a second full-time job in 2023. It was so much, and I underestimated all of it. But they only took 10% of sales profit. So at the end of the day, I still own the rights to my work. I can pick up and go to a new publisher, or if a big five picks up my second book and we wanted to rethink and, you know, do a re-release, or, you know, so I still have all that autonomy with my own work, and that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. As long as you accept the work that goes into it. So just look at what the publishers have done in the past. If you can try and find their previous sales, talk to other authors who have used that publisher or these indie publishers and make sure it's a good fit for you. But I was just excited that somebody said yes. And I was like, yeah, I'm in, let's do it.
Yeah.
And I learned as I went through it.
Ryan, how about you?
No, same experience. And it's hard because there's some qualms that I'm like, I did not know how much extra effort it would take as like another full-time job. And this idea, the having to be my own marketer and PR person has been really challenging. With that said, I'm grateful to have a 100% copyright myself, and frankly, hope my book will be picked up by one of the big five, because I think it is powerful, and that's the goal. So, but like I said, even if I sell one, it's good enough. But the goal is to get it out there eventually.
Yeah, I think the publishing industry overall, my experience with it is that it's a pretty vicious, ruthless industry. This idea that your story, being perhaps a first-time writer, is going to garner you some sort of a multi-$1,000 advance is a pipe dream. That's not going to happen. And the idea that you make money from selling books is also a falsehood, right?
And if I could add in that, as people go about, you know what you want to do with your work, and if there's something you're not willing to negotiate on, then hold firm, be resolute, and be confident in your product. Because I had publishers ask me, oh, we want more dirt on the Obamas. Please talk about their personal lives. And I had a film writer was talking about taking the book to the screen and wanted me to go back and revisit and give more dirt. And I'm like, no, I don't care what kind of money you're trying to throw at me. I am not, that is not what this book is about. And so you just got to, they're looking to sell, and that dirt sells.
Right.
So just be confident in your work that, and be firm in what you want to do with it, because you will get people like that.
I think one of the biggest mistakes people make too is that they think, well, I'm a great proofreader. I don't need to invest in an editor. Ryan, talk about for you, how important was having a good editor?
I loved my editors. They were really great, and I really had a great time with them. They provided really unique insights that I wasn't able to have and really helped me structure my story. With that said, I just want to emphasize, you know, like, yes, there's a problematic, not problematic, just challenges of getting your book published, all that stuff. But at the end of the day, having a story to tell is really powerful, and being able to put it out into the world in whatever form or fashion is a really nice thing to have been able to do. Yes, I wish there were more things that I would have known before. With that said, I'm ultimately glad that my story is out there.
Yep. Get an editor. If you're going to write, hire an editor. That is the most important investment you can make, next to, you know, someone who knows how to market. But if you don't have a product that is clean and free of grammar, spelling, and typos, you can't sell it. So get an editor. That's my piece of advice. Corey, as you think about, you've been doing a lot of traveling around and had some pretty remarkable experiences in the marketing piece of it. What's one experience that stands out to you that you got from doing this book that you wouldn't have had otherwise?
Getting to go to New York and DC to do national interviews for Cheddar News, Nightline. I was on ABC Studios and sitting at David Muir's desk as we're filming this piece. And I'm like, what is going on right now? How is this possible that I'm sitting here being interviewed by ABC? And then the next morning, taking the train to do Good Morning Washington. It was just something I never thought, because I was always the one behind the camera as the Obamas were doing their work in front of the cameras. And now all of a sudden I'm the one in front of the camera. And now apparently I do really good public speaking because of all this experience. So yeah, it's been good.
Fantastic. Ryan, how about for you? What's the standout experience so far?
Well, so far I've been starting with friends and family. So actually reuniting with many of the people that I allude to or people who are part of the experiences in my book, and just getting to reconnect with some of these pinnacle people in my life and go back through the story. And many have been moved to tears. Many have looked back at that time and rethought maybe the ways in which they even treated me or the subjects in which I was working on. And so it's just been really relieving to be able to get the story out there.
Awesome. Well, we've got just about a minute left. Corey, give us the name of your book and where people can go to get it.
Absolutely. Breaking Free, A Saga of Self-Discovery by a Gay Secret Service Agent. It is a mouthful, but all info can be found on CoreyAllenBooks.com. Links to my current writing, whatever you're looking for, as well as social media. Everything is at author Corey Allen. So thank you so much, Greg.
Awesome. Ryan, the name of your book and where people can go to get it.
Well, my book is Finding My Humanity, and it can be found on all major platforms from Amazon, Apple to Walmart, Target, all that stuff. That's one good thing about my previous publisher. They at least you can find it in the marketplace. You just have to look it for it. Again, Finding My Humanity by Ryan Ubuntu Olson. And all my social media is at Ryan Ubuntu Olson. There you go.
Fantastic. And if you missed any of that, we'll have links on our website at outbeatnews.com. Just click on show notes at the top of the page, and we'll have links to be able to buy Corey and Ryan's books. Happy Pride to you both. Thank you so much for celebrating your stories with us and inspiring, hopefully, our listeners to share their own stories.
Thank you for the amazing work that you do, Greg. We appreciate it.
And that wraps up our hour. Don't forget, next weekend is San Francisco Pride. You can learn all of the information about the festival and parade at sfpride.org. And then tune in next Sunday night at 8 p.m. for an Outbeat Extra with Gary Carnevale. In the meantime, have a great week, happy Pride, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County, with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. The Jazz Hot is next.